For the sake of time, we're going to skip the tugboat and the barge. We'll just have to come back next time for that. In the mid-60s, the city of Rochester, New York was in serious trouble. Unemployment was rising and crime was rising with it. And as tensions increased in the urban neighborhoods, the city seemed to feel like it was on the verge of race riots as summer approached. And so a number of ministers and clergy of different faith communities, other community leaders, looking around and seeing that their people were in trouble, decided to come together and try to create a new organization that might address some of the problems that faced them. And so they came together and they assessed the situation, and it didn't take long for them to figure out where to put their energies, which was the Eastman Kodak Company. Because Kodak, while I believe a few months ago they declared bankruptcy, at the time they were an economic powerhouse. They were headquartered in Rochester, and they basically ran the economics and even the politics of the city. So these leaders came together and they came up with a few simple demands for Eastman Kodak. Number one, hire more people of color from the local communities where they were headquartered. And number two, provide some money for job training so that their local residents would have the skills for the jobs that were available. Well, not only would Eastman Kodak not agree to their demands, they wouldn't even recognize them as representatives of their neighborhood. They wouldn't even meet with them to discuss the demands. And so the leaders called in somebody to help them out, a person named Saul Alinsky, who was a community organizer, and among other things, helped to create the school of community organizing that eventually trained someone you may have heard of named Barack Obama. Well, Alinsky sat down with them, and they went through the usual list of tactics to put pressure on a company like that, and they decided that the usual list wasn't going to work. Eastman Kodak was just too big and too powerful. You can't protest a company in one city if they're a multinational company bringing in profits from all over the world. And you can't call for a boycott of a company if they have a monopoly in their industry. Because you'd have to ask people to stop taking pictures of their grandkids altogether, and that will never happen. And so they were sitting in this meeting and they started grasping at any ideas they could come up with to try and put some kind of pressure on Kodak, some kind of pressure to meet with them and consider their demands. And someone had this idea. They said, well, what if we could get some proxies to get into the annual shareholder meeting of the company? So you may know that if you own stock in a company, for every share that you own, you get a vote at the annual meeting. And if you can't make it to the annual meeting physically, you can give your vote to someone else and they can vote on your behalf. So they thought, maybe somebody somewhere will give us a couple proxies, we can get into the meeting, and then, well, they didn't really know what then, but they thought they could cause some kind of trouble. Well, the campaign continued along. Slowly, they brought in more communities, more congregations, more leaders. They built relationships in the neighborhoods, but they weren't really making the progress they wanted until that summer when us Unitarian Universalists got involved. Because that happened to be the year that Alinsky was speaking at our General Assembly. And while he was there, he convinced the delegates of the Assembly to pass a resolution giving all of the UU associations shareholder proxies and Eastman Kodak to the communities of Rochester. So all of a sudden, they had tens of thousands of votes at the annual meeting. And when the delegates, when the association took that collective action, that step that they took together, hand in hand, then congregations saw that and they started to send in their proxies as well. Congregations all over the country. And then individual members of congregations began to send their proxies in as well. And then when other faith communities saw what we had started, they joined in too. And it wasn't long, of course, before things started to shift. There were congressmen that hadn't been calling Alinsky back. Well, now they called him up and they said, you know, this is really an issue I care a lot about. And so there started to be congressional hearings. And of course, with all of this momentum, it wasn't long before not only did Eastman Kodak agree to hire more local residents from the neighborhoods, working class neighborhoods, not only did they begin to provide money for job training, but they also pressured the local municipalities, which they essentially ran, into improving conditions in the neighborhood. Today, the UUA continues to use shareholder activism to pressure companies to change their policies, and have worked in coalitions with a number of other faith communities to include gender non-discrimination clauses in a number of companies' policies. And you can actually go to the UUA website, find out what they're working on, and line up your proxies to vote alongside theirs. Now, I don't know about you, but I am absolutely inspired by this moment in Unitarian Universalist history where we came together and we first of all agreed on an issue and then second of all decided to work together on it. Does this happen in your committee meetings? Not mine, I'll tell you. Today we continue to hear about the problems that face our neighborhoods and our cities, our state and our country. And they're not really all that different from the problems and struggles of Rochester 40-something years ago. We know that corporations all over the country continue to give more promotions and bigger paychecks to white people. And on a similar note, the immigration laws passed in Arizona and even more severe laws passed since then in other states across the South necessitate some collective conversation among us as people of faith. We know that there are deeper questions behind the shallow headlines that we read. There are questions of what does it really mean to love my neighbor? And how do I act on that? And perhaps the most difficult question is who is my neighbor? These are questions that you've struggled with. Would you say out loud right now, who is my neighbor? Racism is not only an issue of corporations perpetuating and expanding inequalities, and it is not only a question of white descendants of immigrants treating our new neighbors with unkindness, but it's also people of color and the working class who are being hit first and worst by the dangers of climate change, a problem of a scale and complexity without precedent. Addressing the issues of our time such as these will require changes not just in the small habits of our lives and lifestyles, but in the institutions that we're a part of. Luckily, though, as Unitarian Universalists, the kind of collective action required of us is built into the heart of our faith community, our covenantal faith community. There's a lot that we can learn from that struggle in Rochester 40-something years ago when the collective power of the UUA joined with the organized resistance of Rochester. Stories like this, where we came together as a faith community and reached out our hands to those beyond our walls, actually fill up our history as Unitarian Universalists. And these stories of our history, I think, challenge us with some tough questions about how we will come together to address the issues of our time. What kind of actions will we need to take together to democratize our economy or our legislative process? Or even if we want to turn climate change around. These big questions remind me of a small quote by environmentalist Bill McKibben, who was speaking of individuals moving to fluorescent light bulbs in their homes to save energy. He said, "That's an important thing to do, but the thing is, our climate problem is past the point where we can make the math work one light bulb at a time. It's past the point where we can make the math work one light bulb at a time." Well, that seems a little pessimistic, but thinking on that, I was reminded of another campaign I worked on against a company you may have heard of called Victoria's Secret. Have you heard of them? Victoria's Secret, at the time of the campaign, was sending out 1 million catalogs a day, and they were using endangered forests for the paper for their junk mail. And when our organization, led largely by UUs working with an environmental group, when we called them up and asked them to consider switching to recycled or at least sustainably logged paper, or perhaps even maybe not send out 1 million catalogs a day, they were confused. And they said, "What do you mean we need to become more sustainable? You probably didn't know that we just changed all of the light bulbs in our headquarters to long-lasting fluorescents." "Well, congratulations," we said. "That's great. But the idea that it's okay to turn acres of ancient forests into junk mail every day, as long as you use better light bulbs at home, that's ridiculous." It's not really their fault, though, when a company says something like that. They're just following this wider trend in our culture that says small individual actions are enough. As long as you change some light bulbs, you're doing your part. But the idea that they can do that and that it balances out the math of the environmental destruction they're causing is certainly ridiculous, because the math just doesn't add up that way. For Victoria's Secret, it took thousands of activists protesting outside and inside their stores before we brought about the pressure that eventually caused them to decide to end their use of endangered forests for junk mail, so that today they actually work for environmentalists lobbying other governments and other industry leaders to change their logging policies. That didn't happen, though, without a lot of flyers hidden in a lot of drawers of underwear. It's a true story. So what does Victoria's Secret and light bulbs and proxy battles have to do with Unitarian Universalism and our purpose here on Sunday mornings? Unitarian Universalists sometimes struggle to articulate what it is that defines us. Sometimes when neighbors or colleagues ask us about what it is we do here and what we believe, sometimes we give them a list of things we don't believe in. And we do that in place of sharing the stories of transformation that surround us in this community. What does set us apart is our way of creating covenant together. In Unitarian Universalism, our covenant is an agreement of how we will live together. Ours is a faith of interdependence, and covenant is how we do interdependence. And we know a covenantal community not just because we read about it in the bylaws or the articles of incorporation, although we may find it there, but we really know it by how it holds us in relationship together. When I had finished music school and I had gone traveling and lived with my parents for a while, I eventually moved back to Boston to begin my life as a musician, and I picked up the phone to call all of my friends that I had gone to college with, and they had all moved away, mostly to New York or LA. And I found myself alone in what seemed like a very new city, except, though, for the young adult group at the congregation where I had been a member, because they were still there. And so when I needed a truck to move to my first apartment, it was a young adult that lent me their pickup. And when I didn't have a mattress to sleep on and couldn't afford one as a self-employed musician, it was a young adult that lent me a cushion. And when I locked myself out of that first apartment at midnight in January in Boston, it was a young adult that opened their door and gave me a place to sleep. We know covenantal community by how it holds us in relationship. At the heart of our faith is relationship. It is holier than any scripture or book. If living religiously meant just following God's rule book, that's not hard to do on your own. Almost all of the Ten Commandments can be followed pretty well in isolation, and in my own experience, some of them are probably best followed that way. But Unitarian Universalism demands a community. We believe that some things are better accomplished together, and a spiritual life is one of those. Social justice work is another, and it would be naive to think otherwise. In the words of former UUA President Bill Sinkford, we are better together. If that's been your experience, would you say out loud right now, we are better together? We have envisioned in our hearts and articulated in our principles a goal of world community with peace and liberty and justice for all. By and large, though, we have not reached our potential to make it happen, and I worry it might be because of our tendency to try to do things on our own. Some of us have thought that we could do our part alone in our homes, changing light bulbs. But changing the laws in Arizona takes more than that. And changing the culture of fear that led to those laws takes more than that still. Changing light bulbs and other personal habits are necessary, but they're not sufficient, because the math just doesn't add up that way. It is not enough to have friends of a different racial background or to denounce racism on Fox News by yelling at your TV. Believe me, I have tried. Covenantal religion calls us to take collective action within and beyond our denomination to change the way the media portrays immigrants. It is necessary but not sufficient to turn down the thermostat in winter. Covenantal religion calls us to take collective action within and beyond our denomination to retrofit our housing. It is not enough to quietly and silently observe segregation in our cities and our suburbs. I've tried that too. But covenantal religion calls us to work hand in hand to transform our systems of banking and transit and public school funding so that the balance of access to resources finally reflects the balance of our moral standards. It is necessary but not sufficient to give a portion of our income to charity. Covenantal religion calls us to democratize our economy so that charity isn't so desperately needed. By deciding at this year's General Assembly to step away from business as usual and have a Justice GA together, our denomination is once again standing in solidarity with the most vulnerable among us. We are living our faith of interdependence. Covenantal religion is the ends and the means of living in right relationship, but covenant must happen in action as well as words. UU Mass Action, back in my home state with their incredible legislative work, inspires me with their slogan, "From Cacophony to Choir." The choir, my friends, doesn't need to be preached to, it needs to get organized, and that's what they're doing. When Eastman Kodak and Victoria's Secret mocked our values of democracy with their corporate structures and their inhumane policies, Unitarian Universalists stepped up hand in hand and changed the rules of the game on them. That struggle grew out of a faith that was grounded in covenant and in our relationships together. I invite you to join in the efforts in this expanding movement to deepen our faith in covenant and in relationship with each other and with the marginalized among us. I invite you to covenant in action as well as words. Would you say covenant? To step away from business as usual. To organize the choir. Would you say organize? And to stand on the side of love. Would you say love? To stand on the side of love. Would you say love? I invite you to join me in recommitting to a covenantal faith of interdependence and real social change. May it be so.